She stroked the flesh of the wood.
"Get going," she said.
At first, she walked home, dazed. The surreal experience with a roomful of books and the stunned, broken woman walked alongside her. She could see it on the buildings, like a play. Perhaps it was similar to the way Papa had his Mein Kampf revelation. Wherever she looked, Liesel saw the mayor's wife with the books piled up in her arms. Around corners, she could hear the shuffle of her own hands, disturbing the shelves. She saw the open window, the chandelier of lovely light, and she saw herself leaving, without so much as a word of thanks. Soon, her sedated condition transformed to harassment and self-loathing. She began to rebuke herself.
"You said nothing."
Her head shook vigorously among the hurried footsteps.
"Not a goodbye, not a thank you, not a 'that's the most beautiful sight I've ever seen.' Nothing."
Certainly she was a book thief, but that didn't mean she should have no manners at all. It didn't mean she couldn't be polite. She walked a good few minutes, struggling with indecision. On Munich Street, it came to an end. Just as she could make out the sign that said Steiner, Schneidermeister, she turned and ran back. This time there was no hesitation. She thumped the door, sending an echo of brass through the wood.
Scheiße!
It was not the mayor's wife, but the mayor himself who stood before her. In her hurry, Liesel had neglected to notice the car that sat out front on the street. Moustached and black-suited, the man spoke.
"Can I help you?"
Liesel could say nothing. Not yet. She was bent over, short of air, and fortunately the woman arrived when she'd at least partially recovered. Ilse Hermann stood behind her husband to the side.
"I forgot," Liesel said.
She lifted the bag and addressed the mayor's wife. Despite the forced labor of breath, she fed the words through the gap in the doorway between the mayor and the frame to the woman. Such was her effort to breathe that the words escaped only a few at a time.
"I forgot. I mean, I just wanted," she said, "to thank you."
The mayor's wife bruised herself again. Coming forward to stand beside her husband, she nodded very faintly, waited, and closed the door. It took Liesel a minute or so to leave. She smiled at the steps. Enter the Struggler. Now for a change of scenery. We've both had it too easy till now, my friend, don't you think? How about we forget mulking for a minute or two? It will do us some good. Also, it's important to the story. We will travel a little to a secret storage room, and we will see what we see. A guided tour of suffering. To your left, perhaps your right, perhaps even straight ahead, you find a small black room. In it sits a Jew. He is scum. He is starving. He is afraid. Please, try not to look away. A few hundred miles northwest, in Stuttgart, far from the book thieves, mayor's wives, and Himmel Street, a man was sitting in the dark. It was the best place, they decided. It's harder to find a Jew in the dark. He sat on his suitcase, waiting. How many days had it been now? He had eaten only the foul taste of his own hungry breath for what felt like weeks, and still nothing. Occasionally voices wandered past, and sometimes he longed for them to knuckle the door, to open it, to drag him out into the unbearable light. For now he could only sit on his suitcase couch, hands under his chin, his elbows burning his thighs. There was sleep, starving sleep, and the irritation of half-awakeness and the punishment of the floor. Ignore the itchy feet, don't scratch the soles, and don't move too much. Just leave everything as it is at all cost. It might be time to go soon,
Light like a gun, explosive to the eyes. It might be time to go. It might be time, so wake up. Wake up now, goddammit. Wake up!
The door was opened and shut, and a figure was crouched over him. The hand splashed at the cold waves of his clothes and the grimy currents beneath. A voice came down behind it.
Max, it whispered. Max, wake up!
His eyes did not do anything that shock normally describes. No snapping, no slapping, no jolt. Those things happen when you wake from a bad dream, not when you wake into one. No, his eyes dragged themselves open, from darkness to dim. It was his body that reacted, shrugging upward and throwing out an arm to grip the air. The voice calmed him now.
Sorry it's taken so long. I think people have been watching me, and the man with the identity card took longer than I thought, but... There was a pause. It's yours now. Not great quality, but hopefully good enough to get you there if it comes to that.
He crouched down and waved a hand at the suitcase. In his other hand, he held something heavy and flat.
Come on. Off.
Max obeyed, standing and scratching. He could feel the tightening of his bones.
The card is in this.
It was a book.
You should put the map in here, too, and the directions, and there's a key taped to the inside cover.
He clicked open the case as quietly as he could and planted the book like a bomb.
I'll be back in a few days.
He left a small bag filled with bread, fat, and 3 small carrots. Next to it was a bottle of water. There was no apology.
It's the best I could do.
Door open, door shut. Alone again. What came to him immediately then was the sound. Everything was so desperately noisy in the dark when he was alone. Each time he moved, there was the sound of a crease. He felt like a man in a paper suit.
The food.
Max divided the bread into 3 parts and set 2 aside. The one in his hand he immersed himself in, chewing and gulping, forcing it down the dry corridor of his throat. The fat was cold and hard, scaling its way down, occasionally holding on. Big swallows tore them away and sent them below. Then the carrots. Again he set 2 aside and devoured the 3rd. The noise was astounding. Surely the Führer himself could hear the sound of the orange crush in his mouth. It broke his teeth with every bite. When he drank, he was quite positive that he was swallowing them. Next time, he advised himself, drink first. Later, to his relief, when the echoes left him and he found the courage to check with his fingers, each tooth was still there, intact. He tried for a smile, but it didn't come. He could only imagine a meek attempt and a mouthful of broken teeth. For hours, he felt at them. He opened the suitcase and picked up the book. He could not read the title in the dark, and the gamble of striking a match seemed too great right now. When he spoke, it was the taste of a whisper.
Please,
he said.
Please.
He was speaking to a man he had never met. As well as a few other important details, he knew the man's name, Hans Hubermann. Again, he spoke to him, to the distant stranger. He pleaded,
please.
The Attributes of Summer.
So, there you have it. You're well aware of exactly what was coming to Himmel Street by the end of 1940. I know, you know. Liesel Memminger, however, cannot be put into that category. For the book thief, the summer of that year was simple. It consisted of 4 main elements, or attributes. At times, she would wonder which was the most powerful. And the nominees are... 1. Advancing through the shoulder shrug every night. 2. Reading on the floor of the mayor's library. 3. Playing soccer on Himmel Street. 4. The seizure of a different stealing opportunity.
The shoulder shrug, she decided, was excellent. Each night, when she calmed herself from her nightmare, she was soon pleased that she was awake and able to read.
"A few pages?" Papa asked her, and Liesl would nod. Sometimes they would complete a chapter the next afternoon, down in the basement.
The authorities' problem with the book was obvious. The protagonist was a Jew, and he was presented in a positive light. Unforgivable. He was a rich man who was tired of letting life pass him by, what he referred to as the shrugging of the shoulders to the problems and pleasures of a person's time on earth. In the early part of summer in Malking, as Liesl and Papa made their way through the book, this man was travelling to Amsterdam on business, and the snow was shivering outside. The girl loved that, the shivering snow. "That's exactly what it does when it comes down," she told Hans Hubermann. They sat together on the bed, Papa half asleep, and the girl wide awake. Sometimes she watched Papa as he slept, knowing both more and less about him than either of them realized. She often heard him and Mama discussing his lack of work, or talking despondently about Hans going to see their son, only to discover that the young man had left his lodging and was most likely already on his way to war.
"Schlaf gut, Papa," the girl said at those times. "Sleep well."
And she slipped around him, out of bed, to turn off the light. The next attribute, as I've mentioned, was the mayor's library. To exemplify that particular situation, we can look to a cool day in late June. Rudy, to put it mildly, was incensed. Who did Liesl Memminger think she was, telling him she had to take the washing and ironing alone today? Wasn't he good enough to walk the streets with her?
"Stop complaining, Saukel," she reprimanded him. "I just feel bad. You're missing the game."
He looked over his shoulder. "Well, if you put it like that..." There was a schmunzel. "You can stick your washing." He ran off and wasted no time joining a team. When Liesl made it to the top of Himmel Street, she looked back just in time to see him standing in front of the nearest makeshift goals. He was waving.
"Saukel,"
she laughed, and as she held up her hand, she knew completely that he was simultaneously calling her a Saumensch. I think that's as close to love as 11-year-olds can get. She started to run to Grunderstrasse and the mayor's house. Certainly there was sweat and the wrinkled pants of breath stretching out in front of her. But she was reading. The mayor's wife, having let the girl in for the fourth time, was sitting at the desk, simply watching the books. On the second visit, she had given permission for Liesl to pull one out and go through it, which led to another and another, until up to half a dozen books were stuck to her, either clutched beneath her arm or among the pile that was climbing higher in her remaining hand. On this occasion, as Liesl stood in the cool surrounds of the room, her stomach growled, but no reaction was forthcoming from the mute, damaged woman. She was in her bathrobe again. And although she observed the girl several times, it was never for very long. She usually paid more attention to what was next to her, to something missing. The window was opened wide, a square, cool mouth, with occasional gusty surges. Liesl sat on the floor, the books were scattered around her. After 40 minutes, she left. Every title was returned to its place.
"Goodbye, Frau Herrmann."
The words always came as a shock. "Thank you." After which the woman paid her, and she left. Every movement was accounted for, and the book thief ran home. As summer set in, the room full of books became warmer, and with every pick-up or delivery day, the floor was not as painful. Liesl would sit with a small pile of books next to her, and she'd read a few paragraphs of each, trying to memorize the words she didn't know to ask Papa when she made it home. Later on, as an adolescent, when Liesl wrote about those books, she no longer remembered the titles. Not one. Perhaps, had she stolen them, she would have been better equipped. What she did remember was that one of the picture books had a name written clumsily on the inside cover. The name of a boy, Johann Herrmann. Liesl bit down on her lip, but she could not resist it for long. From the floor, she turned and looked up at the bathrobed woman and made an inquiry.
"Johann Hermann," she said. "Who is that?"
The woman looked beside her, somewhere next to the girl's knees. Liesl apologized.
"I'm sorry. I shouldn't be asking such things."
She let the sentence die its own death. The woman's face did not alter, yet somehow she managed to speak.
"He is nothing now in this world," she explained. "He was my..."
The files of recollection. Oh, yes, I definitely remember him. The sky was murky and deep like quicksand. There was a young man parceled up in barbed wire like a giant crown of thorns. I untangled him and carried him out. High above the earth, we sank together to our knees. It was just another day. 1918.
"Apart from everything else," she said, "he froze to death."
For a moment she played with her hands, and she said it again.
"He froze to death. I'm sure of it."
The mayor's wife was just one of a worldwide brigade. You have seen her before, I'm certain, in your stories, your poems, the screens you like to watch. They're everywhere, so why not here? Why not on a shapely hill in a small German town? It's as good a place to suffer as any. The point is, Ilse Hermann had decided to make her suffering her triumph. When it refused to let go of her, she succumbed to it. She embraced it. She could have shot herself, scratched herself, or indulged in other forms of self-mutilation, but she chose what she probably felt was the weakest option. To at least endure the discomfort of the weather. For all Liesl knew, she prayed for summer days that were cold and wet. For the most part, she lived in the right place. When Liesl left that day, she said something with great uneasiness. In translation, two giant words were struggled with, carried on her shoulder, and dropped as a bungling pair at Ilse Hermann's feet. They fell off sideways as the girl veered with them and could no longer sustain their weight. Together they sat on the floor, large and loud and clumsy. Two giant words.
"I'm sorry."
Again, the mayor's wife watched the space next to her. A blank page face.
"For what?"
she asked, but time had elapsed by then. The girl was already well out of the room. She was nearly at the front door. When she heard it, Liesl stopped, but she chose not to go back, preferring to make her way noiselessly from the house and down the steps. She took in the view of Molking before disappearing down into it, and she pitied the mayor's wife for quite a while. At times, Liesl wondered if she should simply leave the woman alone, but Ilse Hermann was too interesting, and the pull of the books was too strong. Once, words had rendered Liesl useless, but now, when she sat on the floor, with the mayor's wife at her husband's desk, she felt an innate sense of power. It happened every time she deciphered a new word or pieced together a sentence. She was a girl in Nazi Germany. How fitting that she was discovering the power of words. And how awful, and yet exhilarating, it would feel many months later, when she would unleash the power of this newfound discovery the very moment the mayor's wife let her down. How quickly the pity would leave her, and how quickly it would spill over into something else completely. Now, though, in the summer of 1940, she could not see what lay ahead in more ways than one. She was witness only to a sorrowful woman with a roomful of books whom she enjoyed visiting. That was all. It was part two of her existence that summer. Part three, thank God, was a little more light-hearted. Himmel Street Soccer. Allow me to play you a picture. Feet scuffing road, the rush of boyish breath. Shouted words, "Here, this way, Scheiße!" The coarse bounce of ball on road. All were present on Himmel Street, as well as the sound of apologies, as summer further intensified. The apologies belonged to Liesl Memminger. They were directed at Tommy Müller. By the start of July, she finally managed to convince him that she wasn't going to kill him. Since the beating she'd handed him the previous November, Tommy was still frightened to be around her. In the soccer meetings on Himmel Street, he kept well clear.
"You never know when she might snap," he'd confided in Rudy, half twitching, half speaking.
In Liesl's defense, she never gave up on trying to put him at ease. It disappointed her that she'd successfully made peace with Ludwig Schmeichel and not with the innocent Tommy Müller. He still cowered slightly whenever he saw her.
"How could I know you were smiling for me that day?" she asked him repeatedly.
She'd even put in a few stints as goalie for him, until everyone else on the team begged him to go back in.
"Get back in there," a boy named Harald Mollenhauer finally ordered him. "You're useless."
This was after Tommy tripped him up as he was about to score. He would have awarded himself a penalty, but for the fact that they were on the same side. Liesl came back out and would somehow always end up opposing Rudy. They would tackle and trip each other, call each other names. Rudy would commentate.
"She can't get around him this time, the stupid Zaumensch Arschgrobler. She hasn't got a hope."
He seemed to enjoy calling Liesl an ass scratcher. It was one of the joys of childhood. Another of the joys, of course, was stealing. Part 4, Summer 1940. In fairness, there were many things that brought Rudy and Liesl together, but it was the stealing that cemented their friendship completely. It was brought about by one opportunity, and it was driven by one inescapable force: Rudy's hunger. The boy was permanently dying for something to eat. On top of the rationing situation, his father's business wasn't doing so well of late. The threat of Jewish competition was taken away, but so were the Jewish customers. The Steiners were scratching things together to get by. Like many other people on the Himmel Street side of town, they needed to trade. Liesl would have given him some food from her place, but there wasn't an abundance of it there either. Mama usually made pea soup. On Sunday nights she cooked it, and not just enough for one or two repeat performances. She made enough pea soup to last until the following Saturday. Then on Sunday she'd cook another one. Pea soup, bread, sometimes a small portion of potatoes or meat. You ate it up, and you didn't ask for more, and you didn't complain. At first they did things to try to forget about it. Rudy wouldn't be hungry if they played soccer on the street, or if they took bikes from his brother and sister and rode to Alex Steiner's shop, or visited Liesl's papa if he was working that particular day. Hans Hubermann would sit with them and tell jokes in the last light of afternoon. With the arrival of a few hot days, another distraction was learning to swim in the Amper River. The water was still a little too cold, but they went anyway.
"Come on," Rudy coaxed her in. "Just here. It isn't so deep here."
She couldn't see the giant hole she was walking into and sank straight to the bottom. Dog paddling saved her life, despite nearly choking on the swollen intake of water.
"You Saukerl," she accused him
when she collapsed onto the riverbank. Rudy made certain to keep well away. He'd seen what she did to Ludwig Schmeichel.
"You can swim now, can't you?"
Which didn't particularly cheer her up as she marched away. Her hair was pasted to the side of her face, and snot was flowing from her nose. He called after her,
"Does this mean I don't get a kiss for teaching you? Saukerl?"
The nerve of him. It was inevitable. The depressing pea soup and Rudy's hunger finally drove them to thievery. It inspired their attachment to an older group of kids who stole from the farmers, fruit stealers. After a game of soccer, both Liesl and Rudy learned the benefits of keeping their eyes open. Sitting on Rudy's front step, they noticed Fritz Hammer, one of their older counterparts, eating an apple. It was of the Klar variety, ripening in July and August, and it looked magnificent in his hand. Three or four more of them clearly bulged in his jacket pockets. They wandered closer.
"Where did you get those?" Rudy asked.
The boy only grinned at first.
Shh! And he stopped. He then proceeded to pull an apple from his pocket and toss it over.
Just look at it, he warned them. Don't eat it.
The next time they saw the same boy wearing the same jacket, on a day that was too warm for it, they followed him. He led them toward the upstream section of the Amper River. It was close to where Liesl sometimes read with her papa when she was first learning. A group of five boys, some lanky, a few short and lean, stood waiting. There were a few such groups in Malking at the time, some with members as young as six. The leader of this particular outfit was an agreeable 15-year-old criminal named Arthur Berg. He looked around and saw the two 11-year-olds dangling off the back.
"Und?" he asked. "And?"
"I'm starving," Rudy replied. "And he's fast," said Liesl.
Berg looked at her. "I don't recall asking for your opinion."
He was teenage tall and had a long neck. Pimples were gathered in peer groups on his face.
"But I like you."
He was friendly in a smart-mouthed adolescent way.
"Isn't this the one who beat up your brother, Andel?"
Word had certainly made its way around. A good hiding transcends the divides of age. Another boy, one of the short, lean ones, with shaggy blonde hair and ice-colored skin, looked over.
"I think so,"
Rudy confirmed.
"It is."
Andy Schmeichel walked across and studied her up and down, his face pensive, before breaking into a gaping smile.
"Great work, kid."
He even slapped her among the bones of her back, catching a sharp piece of shoulder blade.
"I'd get whipped for it if I did it myself."
Arthur had moved on to Rudy. "And you're the Jesse Owens one, aren't you?" Rudy nodded.
"Clearly," said Arthur, "you're an idiot. But you're our kind of idiot. Come on."
They were in. When they reached the farm, Liesl and Rudy were thrown a sack. Arthur Berg gripped his own burlap bag. He ran a hand through his mild strands of hair.
"Either of you ever stolen before?"
"Of course," Rudy certified. "All the time."
He was not very convincing.
Liesl was more specific. "I've stolen two books."
At which Arthur laughed in three short snorts. His pimples shifted position.
"You can't eat books, sweetheart."
From there, they all examined the apple trees who stood in long, twisted rows. Arthur Berg gave the orders.
"One," he said, "don't get caught on the fence. You get caught on the fence, you get left behind. Understood?"
Everyone nodded or said yes.
"Two, one in the tree, one below. Someone has to collect."
He rubbed his hands together. He was enjoying this.
"Three, if you see someone coming, you call out loud enough to wake the dead, and we all run. Richtig?
Richtig."
It was a chorus. Two debutant apple thieves whispering.
"Liesl, are you sure? Do you still want to do this?"
"Look at the barbed wire, Rudy. It's so high."
"No, no, look, you throw the sack on. See? Like them."
"All right.
Come on, then."
"I can't."
Hesitation.
"Rudy, I..."
"Move it, Saumensch."
He pushed her toward the fence, threw the empty sack on the wire, and they climbed over, running toward the others. Rudy made his way up the closest tree and started flinging down the apples. Liesl stood below, putting them into the sack. By the time it was full, there was another problem.
"How do we get back over the fence?"
The answer came when they noticed Arthur Berg climbing as close to a fence post as possible. "The wire's stronger there," Rudy pointed. He threw the sack over, made Liesl go first, then landed beside her on the other side among the fruit that spilled from the bag. Next to them, the long legs of Arthur Berg stood watching in amusement.
"Not bad," landed the voice from above. "Not bad at all."
When they made it back to the river, hidden among the trees, he took the sack and gave Liesl and Rudy a dozen apples between them.
"Good work," was his final comment on the matter.
That afternoon, before they returned home, Liesl and Rudy consumed six apples apiece within half an hour. At first,
They entertained thoughts of sharing the fruit at their respective homes, but there was considerable danger in that. They didn't particularly relish the opportunity of explaining just where the fruit had come from. Liesel even thought that perhaps she could get away with only telling Papa, but she didn't want him thinking that he had a compulsive criminal on his hands. So she ate. On the riverbank where she learned to swim, each apple was disposed of. Unaccustomed to such luxury, they knew it was likely they'd be sick. They ate anyway.
"Sau Mensch!" Mama abused her that night. "Why are you vomiting so much?"
"Maybe it's the pea soup," Liesel suggested.
"That's right," Papa echoed. He was over at the window again.
"It must be. I feel a bit sick myself."
"Who asked you, Sau Kerl?"
Quickly she turned back to face the vomiting Sau Mensch.
"Well, what is it? What is it, you filthy pig?"
But Liesel, she said nothing. The apples, she thought happily. The apples. And she vomited one more time, for luck. The Aryan Shopkeeper. They stood outside Frau Diller's against the whitewashed wall. A piece of candy was in Liesel Memminger's mouth. The sun was in her eyes. Despite these difficulties, she was still able to speak and argue. Another conversation between Rudy and Liesel.
"Hurry up, Sau Mensch. That's 10 already."
"It's not. It's only 8. I've got 2 to go."
"Well, hurry up then. I told you we should have gotten a knife and sawn it in half. Come on, that's 2. All right, here. And don't swallow it."
"Do I look like an idiot?"
A short pause.
"This is great, isn't it?"
"It sure is, Sau Mensch." At the end of August and summer, they found 1 pfennig on the ground. Pure excitement. It was sitting half rotten in some dirt on the washing and ironing route. A solitary, corroded coin.
"Take a look at that!"
Rudy swooped on it. The excitement almost stung as they rushed back to Frau Diller's, not even considering that a single pfennig might not be the right price. They burst through the door and stood in front of the Aryan shopkeeper, who regarded them with contempt.
"I'm waiting,"
she said. Her hair was tied back, and her black dress choked her body. The framed photo of the Führer kept watch from the wall.
"Heil Hitler,"
Rudy led.
"Heil Hitler,"
she responded, straightening taller behind the counter.
"And you?"
She glared at Liesel, who promptly gave her a "Heil Hitler" of her own. It didn't take Rudy long to dig the coin from his pocket and place it firmly on the counter. He looked straight into Frau Diller's spectacled eyes and said,
"Mixed candy, please."
Frau Diller smiled. Her teeth elbowed each other for room in her mouth, and her unexpected kindness made Rudy and Liesel smile as well. Not for long. She bent down, did some searching, and came back.
"Here,"
she said, tossing a single piece of candy onto the counter.
"Mix it yourself."
Outside, they unwrapped it and tried biting it in half, but the sugar was like glass. Far too tough even for Rudy's animal-like choppers. Instead, they had to trade sucks on it until it was finished. 10 sucks for Rudy, 10 for Liesel, back and forth. "This," Rudy announced at one point with a candy-toothed grin, "is the good life." And Liesel didn't disagree. By the time they were finished, both their mouths were an exaggerated red, and as they walked home, they reminded each other to keep their eyes peeled in case they found another coin. Naturally, they found nothing. No one can be that lucky twice in 1 year, let alone a single afternoon. Still, with red tongues and teeth, they walked down Himmel Street, happily searching the ground as they went. The day had been a great one, and Nazi Germany was a wondrous place. The Struggler continued. We move forward now to a cold night struggle. We'll let the book thief catch up later. It was November the 3rd, and the floor of the train held onto his feet. In front of him, he read from the copy of Mein Kampf, his savior. Sweat was swimming out of his hands. Finger marks clutched the book.
Book Thief Productions officially presents Mein Kampf, My Struggle, by Adolf Hitler.
Behind Max Vandenberg, the city of Stuttgart opened its arms in mockery. He was not welcome there, and he tried not to look back as the stale bread disintegrated in his stomach. A few times he shifted again and watched the lights become only a handful and then disappear altogether. "Look proud," he advised himself. "You cannot look afraid. Read the book. Smile at it. It's a great book, the greatest book you've ever read. Ignore that woman on the other side. She's asleep now, anyway. Come on, Max. You're only a few hours away." As it had turned out, the promised return visit in the Room of Darkness didn't take days. It had taken a week and a half. Then another week till the next, and another, until he lost all sense of the passing of days and hours. He was relocated once more to another small storage room where there was more light, more visits, and more food. Time, however, was running out.
"I'm leaving soon," his friend Walter Kugler told him. "You know how it is. The army."
"I'm sorry, Walter." Walter Kugler, Max's friend from childhood, placed his hand on the Jew's shoulder.
"It could be worse." He looked his friend in his Jewish eyes. "I could be you."
That was their last meeting. A final package was left in the corner, and this time there was a ticket. Walter opened Mein Kampf and slid it inside, next to the map he'd brought with the book itself.
"Page 13, he smiled. "For luck, yes? For luck."
And the two of them embraced.
When the door shut, Max opened the book and examined the ticket. Stuttgart to Munich to Passing.
It left in 2 days, in the night, just in time to make the last connection. From there, he would walk. The map was already in his head, folded in quarters. The key was still taped to the inside cover. He sat for half an hour before stepping toward the bag and opening it. Apart from food, a few other items sat inside. The extra contents of Walter Kugler's gift. One small razor. A spoon, the closest thing to a mirror. Shaving cream. A pair of scissors. When he left it, the storeroom was empty but for the floor. "Goodbye," he whispered. The last thing Max saw was the small mound of hair sitting casually against the wall. "Goodbye." With a clean-shaven face and lopsided yet neatly combed hair, he had walked out of that building a new man. In fact, he walked out German. Hang on a second, he was German. Or more to the point, he had been. In his stomach was the electric combination of nourishment and nausea. He walked to the station. He showed his ticket and identity card, and now he sat in a small box compartment of the train, directly in danger's spotlight.
"Papers!"
That was what he dreaded to hear. It was bad enough when he was stopped on the platform. He knew he could not withstand it twice. The shivering hands, the smell, no, the stench of guilt. He simply couldn't bear it again. Fortunately, they came through early and only asked for the ticket, and now all that was left was a window of small towns, the congregations of lights, and the woman snoring on the other side of the compartment. For most of the journey, he made his way through the book, trying never to look up. The words lolled about in his mouth as he read them. Strangely, as he turned the pages and progressed through the chapters, it was only two words he ever tasted. Mein Kampf. My struggle. The title. Over and over again, as the train prattled on from one German town to the next. Mein Kampf. Of all the things to save him.
Tricksters.
You could argue that Liesel Memminger had it easy.
She did have it easy compared to Max Vandenberg. Certainly her brother practically died in her arms. Her mother abandoned her. But anything was better than being a Jew. In the time leading up to Max's arrival, another washing customer was lost. This time, the Weingartners. The obligatory schimpferei occurred in the kitchen, and Liesel composed herself with the fact that there were still two left, and even better, one of them was the mayor, the wife, the books. As for Liesel's other activities, she was still causing havoc with Rudi Steiner. I would even suggest that they were polishing their wicked ways. They made a few more journeys with Arthur Berg and his friends, keen to prove their worth and extend their thieving repertoire. They took potatoes from one farm, onions from another. Their biggest victory, however, they performed alone. As witnessed earlier, one of the benefits of walking through town was the prospect of finding things on the ground. Another was noticing people, or, more important, the same people, doing identical things week after week. A boy from school, Otto Sturm, was one such person. Every Friday afternoon, he rode his bike to church, carrying goods to the priests. For a month, they watched him as good weather turned to bad, and Rudi in particular was determined that one Friday, in an abnormally frosty week in October, Otto wouldn't quite make it. "All those priests," Rudi explained as they walked through town. "They're all too fat anyway. They could do without a feed for a week or so." Liesel could only agree. First of all, she wasn't Catholic. Second, she was pretty hungry herself. As always, she was carrying the washing. Rudi was carrying two buckets of cold water, or as he put it, two buckets of future ice. Just before 2 o'clock, he went to work. Without any hesitation, he poured the water onto the road in the exact position where Otto would pedal around the corner. Liesel had to admit it. There was a small portion of guilt at first, but the plan was perfect, or at least as close to perfect as it could be. At just after 2 o'clock every Friday, Otto Sturm turned onto Munich Street with the produce in his front basket at the handlebars. On this particular Friday, that was as far as he would travel. The road was icy as it was, but Rudi put on the extra coat, barely able to contain a grin. It ran across his face like a skid. "Come on," he said, "that bush there." After approximately 15 minutes, the diabolical plan bore its fruit, so to speak. Rudi pointed his finger into a gap in the bush. "There he is." Otto came around the corner, dopey as a lamb. He wasted no time in losing control of the bike, sliding across the ice and lying face down on the road. When he didn't move, Rudi looked at Liesel with alarm. "Crucified Christ," he said. "I think we might have killed him." He crept slowly out, removed the basket, and they made their getaway. "Was he breathing?" Liesel asked, farther down the street. "Keine Ahnung," Rudi said, clinging to the basket. He had no idea. From far down the hill, they watched as Otto stood up, scratched his head, scratched his crotch, and looked everywhere for the basket. "Stupid Scheißkopf," Rudi grinned, and they looked through the spoils. Bread, broken eggs, and the big one, Speck. Rudi held the fatty ham to his nose and breathed it gloriously in. Beautiful. As tempting as it was to keep the victory to themselves, they were overpowered by a sense of loyalty to Arthur Berg. They made their way to his impoverished lodging on Kempfstrasse and showed him the produce. Arthur couldn't hold back his approval. "Who did you steal this from?" It was Rudi who answered. "Otto Sturm." "Well," he nodded, "whoever that is, I'm grateful to him." He walked inside and returned with a bread knife, a frying pan, and a jacket, and the three thieves walked the hallway of apartments. "We'll get the others," Arthur Berg stated as they made it outside. "We might be criminals, but we're not totally immoral." Much like the book thief, he at least drew the line somewhere. A few more doors were knocked on,
Names were called out to apartments from streets below, and soon the whole conglomerate of Arthur Berg's fruit-stealing troop was on its way to the Amper. In the clearing on the other side, a fire was lit, and what was left of the eggs was salvaged and fried. The bread and speck were cut. With hands and knives, every last piece of Otto Sturm's delivery was eaten. No priest in sight. It was only at the end that an argument developed regarding the basket. The majority of boys wanted to burn it. Fritz Hammer and Andy Schmeichel wanted to keep it, but Arthur Berg, showing his incongruous moral aptitude, had a better idea. "You two," he said to Rudy and Liesel, "maybe you should take it back to that Sturm character. I'd say that poor bastard probably deserves that much." "Oh, come on, Arthur." "I don't want to hear it, Andy." "Jesus Christ, he doesn't want to hear it either." The group laughed, and Rudy Steiner picked up the basket. "I'll take it back and hang it on their mailbox." He had walked only 20 meters or so when the girl caught up. She would be home far too late for comfort, but she was well aware that she had to accompany Rudy Steiner through town, to the Sturm farm on the other side. For a long time they walked in silence.
"Do you feel bad?" Liesel finally asked.
They were already on the way home.
"About what?"
"You know."
"Of course I do. But I'm not hungry anymore, and I bet he's not hungry either. Don't think for a second that the priests would get food if there wasn't enough to go around at home. He just hit the ground so hard. Don't remind me."
But Rudy Steiner couldn't resist smiling. In years to come, he would be a giver of bread, not a stealer. Proof again of the contradictory human being. So much good, so much evil. Just add water. 5 days after their bittersweet little victory, Arthur Berg emerged again and invited them on his next stealing project. They ran into him on Munich Street, on the way home from school on a Wednesday. He was already in his Hitler Youth uniform.
"We're going again tomorrow afternoon. You interested?"
They couldn't help themselves.
"Where?" "The potato place."
24 hours later, Liesel and Rudy braved the wire fence again and filled their sack. The problem showed up as they made their getaway.
"Christ!" shouted Arthur. "The farmer!"
It was his next word, however, that frightened. He called it out as if he'd already been attacked with it. His mouth ripped open, the word flew out, and the word was axe. Sure enough, when they turned around, the farmer was running at them, the weapon held aloft. The whole group ran for the fence line and made their way over. Rudy, who was farthest away, caught up quickly, but not quickly enough to avoid being last. As he pulled his leg up, he became entangled.
"Hey!"
the sound of the stranded. The group stopped. Instinctively, Liesel ran back.
"Hurry up!"
Arthur called out. His voice was far away, as if he'd swallowed it before it exited his mouth. White sky. The others ran. Liesel arrived and started pulling at the fabric of his pants. Rudy's eyes were opened wide with fear.
"Quick!" he said. "He's coming!"
Far off, they could still hear the sound of deserting feet, when an extra hand grabbed the wire and reefed it away from Rudy Steiner's pants. A piece was left on the metallic knot, but the boy was able to escape.
"Now move it!" Arthur advised them, not long before the farmer arrived, swearing and struggling for breath.
The axe held on now, with force, to his leg. He called out the futile words of the robbed.
"I'll have you arrested! I'll find you! I'll find out who you are!"
That was when Arthur Berg replied.
"The name is Owens."
He loped away, catching up to Liesel and Rudy.
"Jesse Owens."
When they made it to safe ground, fighting to suck the air into their lungs, they sat down and Arthur Berg came over. Rudy wouldn't look at him.
"It's happened to all of us," Arthur said, sensing the disappointment.
Was he lying? They couldn't be sure. And they would never find out. A few weeks later, Arthur Berg moved to Cologne. They saw him once more on one of Liesel's washing delivery rounds.
in an alleyway off Munich Street, he handed Liesel a brown paper bag containing a dozen chestnuts. He smirked. A contact in the roasting industry. After informing them of his departure, he managed to proffer a last pimply smile and to cuff each of them on the forehead. Don't go eating all those things at once, either. And they never saw Arthur Berg again. As for me, I can tell you that I most definitely saw him. A small tribute to Arthur Berg, a still living man. The Cologne sky was yellow and rotting, flaking at the edges. He sat propped against a wall, with a child in his arms. His sister. When she stopped breathing, he stayed with her, and I could sense he would hold her for hours. There were two stolen apples in his pocket. This time they played it smarter. They ate one chestnut each and sold the rest of them door to door.
If you have a few pfennig to spare, Liesel said at each house, I have chestnuts.
They ended up with 16 coins. Now, Rudy grinned, revenge. That same afternoon, they returned to Frau Diller's, Heil Hitler'd, and waited.
Mixed candy again?
She schmunzelt, to which they nodded. The money splashed the counter, and Frau Diller's smile fell slightly ajar.
Yes, Frau Diller, they said in unison. Mixed candy, please.
The framed Führer looked proud of them. Triumph before the storm. The Struggler concluded. The juggling comes to an end now, but the struggling does not. I have Liesel Memminger in one hand, Max Vandenberg in the other. Soon I will clap them together. Just give me a few pages. The Struggler. If they killed him tonight, at least he would die alive. The train ride was far away now. The snorer most likely tucked up in the carriage she'd made her bed, travelling on. Now there were only footsteps between Max and survival. Footsteps and thoughts. And doubts. He followed the map in his mind, from passing to Molking. It was late when he saw the town. His legs ached terribly, but he was nearly there, the most dangerous place to be. Close enough to touch it. Just as it was described, he found Munich Street and made his way along the footpath. Everything stiffened. Glowing pockets of streetlights, dark, passive buildings. The town hall stood like a giant, ham-fisted youth, too big for his age. The church disappeared in darkness the farther his eyes travelled upward. It all watched him. He shivered. He warned himself. Keep your eyes open. German children were on the lookout for stray coins. German Jews kept watch for possible capture. In keeping with the usage of number 13 for luck, he counted his footsteps in groups of that number. Just 13 footsteps, he would tell himself. Come on, just 13 more. As an estimate, he completed 90 sets, till at last he stood on the corner of Himmel Street. In one hand, he held his suitcase. The other was still holding Mein Kampf. Both were heavy, and both were handled with a gentle secretion of sweat. Now he turned onto the side street, making his way to number 33, resisting the urge to smile, resisting the urge to sob, or even imagine the safety that might be awaiting him. He reminded himself that this was no time for hope. Certainly, he could almost touch it. He could feel it somewhere just out of reach. Instead of acknowledging it, he went about the business of deciding again what to do, if he was caught at the last moment, or if by some chance the wrong person awaited him inside. Of course, there was also the scratchy feeling of sin. How could he do this? How could he show up and ask people to risk their lives for him? How could he be so selfish? 33. They looked at each other. The house was pale almost sick-looking, with an iron gate and a brown, spit-stained door. From his pocket, he pulled out the key. It did not sparkle, but lay dull and limp in his hand. For a moment, he squeezed it, half expecting it to come leaking toward his wrist. It didn't. The metal was hard and flat, with a healthy set of teeth, and he squeezed it till it pierced him. Slowly, then, the struggler leaned forward, his cheek against the wood, and he removed the key from his fist. Part 4. The Standover Man. Featuring the accordionist, a promise keeper, a good girl, a Jewish fistfighter, the wrath of Rosa, a lecture, a sleeper, the swapping of nightmares, and some pages from the basement. The Accordionist. The Secret Life of Hans Hubermann. There was a young man standing in the kitchen. The key in his hand felt like it was rusting into his palm. He didn't speak anything like hello, or please help, or any other such expected sentence. He asked two questions. Question 1. Hans Hubermann. Question 2. Do you still play the accordion? As he looked uncomfortably at the human shape before him, the young man's voice was scraped out and handed across the dark like it was all that remained of him. Papa, alert and appalled, stepped closer. To the kitchen, he whispered. Of course I do. It all dated back many years, to World War I. They're strange, those wars. Full of blood and violence, but also full of stories that are equally difficult to fathom. It's true, people will mutter. I don't care if you don't believe me. It was that fox who saved my life. Or, they died on either side of me and I was left standing there, the only one without a bullet between my eyes. Why me? Why me and not them? Hans Hubermann's story was a little like that. When I found it within the book thief's words, I realized that we passed each other once in a while during that period, though neither of us scheduled a meeting. Personally, I had a lot of work to do. As for Hans, I think he was doing his best to avoid me. The first time we were in the vicinity of each other, Hans was 22 years old, fighting in France. The majority of young men in his platoon were eager to fight. Hans wasn't so sure. I had taken a few of them along the way, but you could say I never even came close to touching Hans Hubermann. He was either too lucky, or he deserved to live, or there was a good reason for him to live. In the army, he didn't stick out at either end. He ran in the middle, climbed in the middle, and he could shoot straight enough so as not to affront his superiors. Nor did he excel enough to be one of the first chosen to run straight at me. A small but noteworthy note. I've seen so many young men over the years who think they're running at other young men. They are not. They're running at me. He'd been in the fight for almost 6 months when he ended up in France, where, at face value, a strange event saved his life. Another perspective would suggest that in the nonsense of war, it made perfect sense. On the whole, his time in the Great War had astonished him from the moment he entered the army. It was like a serial, day after day after day after day. The conversation of bullets, resting men, the best dirty jokes in the world, cold sweat, that malignant little friend, outstaying its welcome in the armpits and trousers. He enjoyed the card games the most, followed by the few games of chess, despite being thoroughly pathetic at it. And the music. Always the music. It was a man a year older than himself, a German Jew named Erich Vandenberg, who taught him to play the accordion. The two of them gradually became friends due to the fact that neither of them was terribly interested in fighting. They preferred rolling cigarettes to rolling in snow and mud. They preferred shooting craps to shooting bullets. A firm friendship was built on gambling, smoking, and music, not to mention a shared desire for survival. The only trouble with this was that Eric Vandenberg would later be found in several pieces on a grassy hill. His eyes were open, and his wedding ring was stolen. I shoveled up his soul with the rest of them, and we drifted away. The horizon was the color of milk, cold and fresh, poured out among the bodies. All that was really left of Eric Vandenberg was a few personal items and the fingerprinted accordion. Everything but the instrument was sent home. It was considered too big. Almost with self-reproach, it sat on his makeshift bed at the base camp and was given to his friend Hans Huberman, who happened to be the only man to survive. He survived like this. He didn't go into battle that day. For that, he had Eric Vandenberg to thank. Or more to the point, Eric Vandenberg and the sergeant's toothbrush. That particular morning, not too long before they were leaving, Sergeant Stefan Schneider paced into the sleeping quarters and called everyone to attention. He was popular with the men for his sense of humor and practical jokes, but more so for the fact that he never followed anyone into the fire. He always went first. On certain days, he was inclined to enter the room of resting men and say something like, "Who comes from passing?" or "Who's good with mathematics?" or, in the fateful case of Hans Huberman, "Who's got neat handwriting?" No one ever volunteered, not after the first time he did it. On that day, an eager young soldier named Philip Schlink stood proudly up and said, "Yes, sir, I come from passing." He was promptly handed a toothbrush and told to clean the shithouse. When the sergeant asked who had the best penmanship, you can surely understand why no one was keen to step forward. They thought they might be first to receive a full hygiene inspection or scrub an eccentric lieutenant's shit-trampled boots before they left. "Now come on," Schneider toyed with them. Slapped down with oil, his hair gleamed, though a small piece was always upright and vigilant at the apex of his head. "At least one of you useless bastards must be able to write properly." In the distance, there was gunfire. It triggered a reaction. "Look," said Schneider, "this isn't like the others. It will take all morning, maybe longer." He couldn't resist a smile. "Schlink was polishing that shithouse while the rest of you were playing cards, but this time you're going out there." Life or pride? He was clearly hoping that one of his men would have the intelligence to take life. Eric Vandenberg and Hans Huberman glanced at each other. If someone stepped forward now, the platoon would make his life a living hell for the rest of their time together. No one likes a coward. On the other hand, if someone was to be nominated... Still, no one stepped forward, but a voice stooped out and ambled toward the sergeant. It sat at his feet, waiting for a good kicking. It said, "Huberman, sir." The voice belonged to Eric Vandenberg. He obviously thought that today wasn't the appropriate time for his friend to die. The sergeant paced up and down the passage of soldiers. "Who said that?" He was a superb pacer, Stefan Schneider, a small man who spoke, moved, and acted in a hurry. As he strode up and down the two lines, Hans looked on, waiting for the news. Perhaps one of the nurses was sick, and they needed someone to strip and replace bandages on the infected limbs of injured soldiers. Perhaps 1,000 envelopes were to be licked and sealed, and sent home with death notices in them. At that moment, the voice was put forward again, moving a few others to make themselves heard. "Huberman," they echoed. Eric even said, "Immaculate handwriting, sir. Immaculate." "It's settled, then." There was a circular, small-mouthed grin. "Huberman, you're it." The gangly young soldier made his way forward and asked what his duty might be. The sergeant sighed. "The captain needs a few dozen letters written for him. He's got terrible rheumatism in his fingers, or arthritis. You'll be writing them for him." This was no time to argue, especially when Schlink was sent to clean the toilets, and the other one, Pfleger, nearly killed himself licking envelopes. His tongue was infection blue.
"Yes, sir," Hans nodded.
And that was the end of it. His writing ability was dubious, to say the least, but he considered himself lucky. He wrote the letters as best he could, while the rest of the men went into battle. None of them came back. That was the first time Hans Hubermann escaped me, the Great War. A second escape was still to come, in 1943, in Essen. Two wars for two escapes. Once young, once middle-aged. Not many men are lucky enough to cheat me twice. He carried the accordion with him during the entirety of the war. When he tracked down the family of Erich Vandenberg in Stuttgart upon his return, Vandenberg's wife informed him that he could keep it. Her apartment was littered with them, and it upset her too much to look at that one in particular. The others were reminder enough, as was her once shared profession of teaching it. "He taught me to play," Hans informed her, as though it might help. Perhaps it did, for the devastated woman asked if he could play it for her, and she silently wept as he pressed the buttons and keys of a clumsy Blue Danube waltz. It was her husband's favorite. "You know," Hans explained to her, "he saved my life." The light in the room was small and the air restrained. "If there's anything you ever need..." He slid a piece of paper with his name and address on it across the table. "I'm a painter by trade. I'll paint your apartment for free, whenever you like." He knew it was useless compensation, but he offered anyway. The woman took the paper, and not long after, a small child wandered in and sat on her lap. "This is Max," the woman said, but the boy was too young and shy to say anything. He was skinny, with soft hair, and his thick, murky eyes watched as the stranger played one more song in the heavy room. From face to face, he looked on as the man played, and the woman wept. The different notes handled her eyes. Such sadness. Hans left. "You never told me," he said to a dead Erich Vandenberg and the Stuttgart skyline. "You never told me you had a son." After a momentary head-shaken stoppage, Hans returned to Munich, expecting never to hear from those people again. What he didn't know was that his help would most definitely be needed, but not for painting, and not for another 20 years or so. There were a few weeks before he started painting. In the good weather months he worked vigorously, and even in the winter he often said to Rosa that business might not be pouring, but it would at least drizzle now and again. For more than a decade, it all worked. Hans Jr. and Trudy were born. They grew up making visits to their papa at work, slapping paint on walls and cleaning brushes. When Hitler rose to power in 1933, though, the painting business fell slightly awry. Hans didn't join the NSDAP, like the majority of people did. He put a lot of thought into his decision. The thought process of Hans Hubermann. He was not well-educated or political, but if nothing else, he was a man who appreciated fairness. A Jew had once saved his life, and he couldn't forget that. He couldn't join a party that antagonized people in such a way. Also, much like Alex Steiner, some of his most loyal customers were Jewish. Like many of the Jews believed, he didn't think the hatred could last. And it was a conscious decision not to follow Hitler. On many levels, it was a disastrous one. Once the persecution began, his work slowly dried up. It wasn't too bad to begin with, but soon enough he was losing customers. Handfuls of quotes seemed to vanish into the rising Nazi air. He approached an old faithful named Herbert Bollinger, a man with a hemispheric waistline who spoke Hochdeutsch. He was from Hamburg, when he saw him on Munich Street. At first, the man looked down past his girth to the ground, but when his eyes returned to the painter, the question clearly made him uncomfortable. There was no reason for Hans to ask, but he did. What's going on, Herbert? I'm losing customers quicker than I can count. Bollinger didn't flinch any.